Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me for this week's episode, where I'm joined by Acacia Lewis. We had a conversation back in July, and we got an opportunity to actually meet each other in person at the Entheogenesis event in Austin, Texas, and then a little bit after that at the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference up in Portland, Oregon. And Acacia is just... she's super smart. She's super dynamic. She has a very interesting life story and a very interesting approach to working with high dose psilocybin mushrooms. And we just had a great conversation. I'm excited to bring it to you today here on the podcast. And she's kind of an up and comer on the psychedelic scene. She was someone who didn't really want to get into a speaking role, but was encouraged into that by some of her friends and mentors, and it's a great thing that they did, because she really is quite the dynamic speaker, and it was a pleasure to have a conversation with her, and looking forward to bringing that to you. Just a couple quick announcements before we get to the talk with Acacia. First, just want to say thanks to David, who made a small contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast over this past week via PayPal. If you'd like to support the podcast and support the work that I do here by PayPal or by joining up as a patron over at my Patreon page at the level that's comfortable for you for a monthly subscription, you can stop by my personal webpage, martinball.net, and use either the PayPal or the Patreon link at the top right of the page. Of course, coming up next week, we have another chapter from the Facilitating 5-MeO DMT Anthology. I hope that you're enjoying these little windows into these different worldviews of these different 5-MeO DMT facilitators from around the world, with the first two facilitator sections that I've already shared here on the podcast. I'm sure you can see that there is a world of difference between one person and the next, and how they look at the work with 5-MeO DMT, how they contextualize it, how they serve, how they facilitate, how it fits into their own worldview. And that's the fascinating thing about the anthology, is you get all these different perspectives on the same topic and see that there's really a lot of diversity there. So looking forward to continuing bringing you that between interviews. Of course, the entire audiobook is available over at Audible, Amazon, and the iBookstore, along with my other audiobooks. And of course, it's also available in paperback and ebook if you just want to grab that. Coming up also on the podcast, have kind of an interesting conversation to share with you with an individual named Daniel, who came to me to do an integration call, and it was his suggestion that we record the integration call and produce it as a podcast and put it out there for people to kind of get a sample of what integration work can be like in real time. Of course, if you are looking for some help with integrating your entheogenic experience, I'm always here to help. You can stop by at www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com. I'm available for 30, 60, and 90-minute video calls, and I'm always happy to converse with you. And also, I do work with facilitators, people who are actually serving medicine, so happy to help in whatever capacity you are most in need of. Also have a conversation coming up on the podcast with Sarah Napik, and it's kind of interesting where we're going to have to do a little bit of a follow-up interview that's coming up in just a couple days that we're going to do, because she is someone who was a BUFO facilitator, then through various circumstances decided to put that down and walk away from it, and now she's kind of getting back into it. So we're going to do a little bit of a follow-up interview, because where we left the interview before, she had just walked away and now she's walking back. So we're going to follow up on that. And I'm in the process of sorting through the large stack of books that I have to see what I'm going to read next and who I'm going to interview next. But so, of course, there's always more to come here on the podcast. You know, I've been doing this for over 15 years now on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, and there's always more people to interview. So it's always keeping it interesting, and hope you enjoy on the listening side of things. So that's all I have to say in terms of announcements to get us started. So let's get into this conversation with Acacia Lewis. Perhaps you'll get a chance to catch her at an upcoming event somewhere near you. And if you do have the opportunity, I highly recommend it, because she's great. She's a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here's Acacia Lewis.
Hey, Acacia.
Whoa, how's it going?
Oh, it's going great.
There, can you see me?
Yeah, I can see you just fine.
Am I upright?
Yes, you are.
Cool.
Awesome. Though, you know, you can stand on your head if you want. It's all right. No one will know.
How's it going?
It's going well today. How's your Monday so far?
I was just cooking an egg and trying to scarf it down before we did this. But well, yeah, I'm here now.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, third time's a charm.
All right. Well, I'm ready when you are.
Okay. Well, we can just go ahead and jump right in, Acacia. I have like a million and one things I want to ask you about. There's like so much interesting that I think that you have to share and say. And I'll just start by saying your talk at the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference was awesome. That was beautiful to see that standing ovation that you got. I mean, you're just a little powerhouse up on stage.
Well, thanks. Yeah. You know, I was really just speaking from the heart, you know. I feel like there's just so much, I guess you could say, gray area when it comes to the conversation about high dose. I just kind of wanted to share kind of more of a clear vision, at least from my own experience, of how I feel about, you know, what it means to do higher dose work and what it doesn't necessarily have to mean.
Yeah.
You know, and namely having a terrible experience or a terrifying experience, does not have to mean that. And it also doesn't have to be something that is more than cultivating a deeper simplicity and understanding of why you're here and what your purpose is. You know, I think sometimes we get into these exaggerated superhero mindsets and we forget that the basics are super, they're super important, you know? I think we spend our whole time, at least folks who do high dose and then go low dose, or do ayahuasca per se, and then go to mushrooms, trying to fit it into their real life. And I propose trying to fit your real life into your high dose experience instead.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's going to be an interesting trajectory to talk about. But so I'll just sort of highlight, here's some of the things that I want to ask you about. And you, of course, are welcome to take the conversation anywhere you want to go, because this is your interview. And I'm just super excited to talk to you because I think it's going to be a lot of fun. But
I had a lot of fun chilling. That was really nice hanging out and eating tacos and stuff. That was cool.
Yeah, yeah. I love also like actually getting to hang out with people like yourself. That was a lot of fun. But here's just a snapshot of some of the things I want to talk to you about. So
okay.
I want to talk to you about how your background, where you come from, how you got into psychedelics. I want to talk about your work with Kalindi, whom I really, really loved. Kalindi, he and I got a few different chances to hang out, and he was just always just fucking kick ass to hang out with. I loved hanging out with Kalindi. You know, you've probably noticed there's a lot of frou-frou, woo-woo, feel-good bullshit in the psychedelic space, and Kalindi was just, man, he's
anti.
Just like, yeah, just
anti
no nonsense.
Anti-bullshit.
Yeah, just love that about him. And then also, I know you are spending a lot of time with Mike Crowley, and he's another person that I just absolutely love, Mike. I've known him for a number of years now. I first met him when he walked into my theme camp at Burning Man, wanting to ask me some questions about something that a friend of mine had presented at a, you know, at some other theme camp at Burning Man. And that was like years and years and years ago, maybe 2009 or something like that. And then also, I know you've been hanging out with Tom Lane and doing some of his, what are they called? The Time Person's work. And you, of course, have just all kinds of insights about high dose mushroom experiences. You're a freaking astrophysicist. I mean, we've got to talk about that. We cannot let that one slide. And you're just a dynamic, beautiful, interesting person. And I'm just been really excited to get to know you. You know, I've seen like your face and your name has kind of popped up a couple different places. Then I was really excited that we were going to be at Entheogenesis together, but I didn't get a chance to catch your talk there. Did stick around for Sunday at Sanctum specifically to hear your talk, and really glad that I did. So just welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here. And yeah, let's start with, where do you come from and how did you get into all this? And I know that there's a bit of sort of a dark personal tale there, but wherever you want to begin, Acacia, the floor is yours.
Well, for starters, I would say kind of just, I'm just from, Not necessarily like even like a town that people even know about. Like Bloomington, Indiana is a really small town, and it's, you know, it's home to Indiana University. That's where I was born. And I grew up in North Texas in Plano, Texas, which is an all-American city. So it's like one of those towns that you look at on a map and you're just kind of like, okay, that exists, but very no distinguishing qualities. It has one of the largest Asian populations, a very small African-American population, but it's one of the most diverse towns, I think, in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
It is called Plano is the name?
Plano,
like,
yeah.
Plano.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it is how it sounds. It's completely flat. There's no hills. There's no natural lakes or bodies of water. It's there's a lot of trees that are all planted. You know, it's kind of an all-American town, you know, and I was homeschooled there. And so for me personally, people ask me where I'm from, like, I can say Dallas because everyone knows Dallas, but yeah. You know, the truth is it was more like 60 miles north of Dallas, McKinney, Plano area. I grew up officially, I guess you could say, like more like McKinney area, back before Stonebridge Ranch was even like built. It's, if anyone who's listening is from there, you know, kind of the nappy, natural, hayfield vibe. That's where I grew up.
Yeah. And I'm just imagining probably psychedelics wasn't a big part of the culture out there.
No, as a matter of fact, it was like shunned. You know, there was a huge news story that came out. The only time we heard about drugs was really like when there were a bunch of heroin addicts in Plano, and apparently for a minute Plano became like a heroin capital. And it's kind of it can be a very depressing place. Like if you don't have money and you don't live in a nice neighborhood, then it's kind of not a place that you really want to be. Psychedelics weren't really even part of the conversation. For me, it was going from Windows 95 to Windows XP and the advent of the internet that brought psychedelics into my space. My dad liked to work on computers, so we would go dumpster diving and find all of these old CPUs and hard drives, and we start, you know, putting together basically franking computers and trying to get them to run. Like I learned how to solder when I was like almost 7 years old, and so, you know, he was working for an elevator company as a draftsman and estimator, and he would basically come up with different ideas, like build a dollhouse, but a dollhouse that has its own elevator, and the elevator has its own switchboard, and, you know, and AutoCAD drawn out. He taught me how to do blueprints and stuff like that, and he was going to college at the time, so I went to college with my father and sat in on most of his classes. And eventually...
Just as an auditor, or were you also...
Just as an auditor. And not really as an auditor, because when we get home, I'd have flashcards from his class and I'd be quizzing him on the questions.
Yeah.
And programming his TI-84 calculator with formulas so that he could scroll back through his calculator and look at the formulas. And then I was writing all the equations on these large poster boards that we had. And eventually I had so many poster boards, there wasn't any other space on my wall when I was a kid other than the poster boards filled with mathematical equations.
And you were processing all this. You understood what you were doing.
All day, all the time. And then when it wasn't math, my mom would do like home EC, and then we'd have reading. And then sometimes, you know, we got to do fun stuff, like listen to Percy Jackson, The Lightning Thief, before the horrible movie came out. There was a book series that was actually pretty decent. And I was, you know, a kid at the time, and I liked it. That's when I really started getting into mythology. And I'm still into mythology and mythological history. But my biggest passion was, like, age 5 and up, going to garage sales and finding National Geographics. Because there was a bunch of out-of-pocket stuff that I couldn't see on TV. And, you know, my parents wouldn't talk to me about, you know, hidden inside of the Himba and the Nazca and the Olmec and the Peruvian articles. And I remember just ripping out the maps of all the old National Geographics from, like, 1970 on up. And, like, having the maps, like, hidden in a stack. Like, I had a stack of all the inserts.
Mm-hmm.
so that I could like study all of the different routes that different peoples took, like from the Oregon Trail literally to like the Aztec Empire, you know. And I really loved learning. And so my parents, you know, would take me to the library, you know, like once or twice a week, and I'd take out as many books as they let me, sometimes 30 or 40 books at a time, and just sit, just speed reading at the dinner table as much as I could, just packing it in, plants, herbs, fish. I really had a thing for guppies. My dad brought home a bunch of guppy fry from work one day when I was like a preteen. Like I was still like 10 years old. Now I think of myself as a preteen, but I was still young. And I started raising these guppy fry, and some of them came out like fancy guppies, and they had like pom-pom shapes and stuff on their tails. And so I started studying the art of breeding fancy guppies. And that passion pretty much never stopped. I still from time to time will go into a Petco and ask them why I don't have any Anacharis for sale. That's one of the plants that we use to hide the fry from the live bearing fish that will eat their young, literally. But yeah, you know, my parents taught me that learning was a really big priority. And so, you know, that segued into me trying to study everything possible about DMT containing plants after I realized that my name was connected to a tree that contained DMT.
Yeah.
But there wasn't that much information online. And, you know, in the early days of Arrowhead and the early days of forums, you know, you could find little things. Sometimes you'd find like someone who made a post asking a question, then you'd have like a bunch of dumb answers or something. Or you'd get on a chat with someone and you'd ask them, do you know anything about this plant? And they just look at you and then it would scroll to the next guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it was pretty much for me in the early days. I didn't really discover psychedelics until experiencing them when I went to college. First thing I found out was don't do Adderall. My friend who lived in a dorm across from me had a heart attack at like age 17 from doing too much Adderall.
Oh, wow.
So all synthetic things were off the table for me at that point. And, I did get some mushroom cookies and some other things that I think were like cannabis edibles, like early cannabis edibles, like reefer chocolate or something. And I knew I really didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling of being high. So I stopped doing cannabis. That changed later on. Like I got into hash much later, like age 21, 22. But that was the very beginning for me. Ground zero, I guess.
Yeah. And if I could just make a little comment that you said that your parents instilled sort of the importance of learning within you. But I just want to comment that, of course, you are a very self-directed individual, because, you know, parents can say that as much as they want. And if the child doesn't have that proclivity within them, it's not necessarily going to land. And, you know, as being a former university professor myself, that I would say it's always the self-directed students. They're always the best ones, because they come in and they're like, look, I really want to learn about this. And I mean, so many students are just give me the minimum. Is this going to be on the test? Versus I fucking love learning. I want information. I want to absorb it. I want to find it. I want to take it in and synthesize it. And that's very much your personality trait. And that's what makes you the powerhouse that you are. And, you know,
I do have two people to thank from college. I would say like Margaret Gonzalez, very, very strict and no nonsense English professor. She was my favorite. Her husband was an astrophysicist, and she's actually the one who recommended to me, maybe you should go study astrophysics since you're non-social. You don't really want to talk, but you get your assignments done faster than everyone else does. And I just wore blue jeans, a striped t-shirt, and a baseball cap. That was like my uniform. Didn't talk to anybody. You said the assignment was due. The assignment got done that day. Yeah. And so me going into college with that mentality raised some red flags with the faculty. So they were like, well, I gave you a week to do this assignment and you did it in 2 days. And it's A quality. Are you okay? And I'm like, no, I'm not okay. I'm really not okay. You know, and so going to my professor's offices, like 6 a.m., 8 a.m., as soon as they get in the building, I just sit there and like they're working on something. I'd be like, okay, what's that? Can I read that? And they're like, no, this is the next level class. I'm like, I don't care. Like, can I do that assignment? And they're like, okay. well, why do you do this? Well, my parents drop me off super early so I won't be late to class because they expect me to do a certain amount of homework. And they're like, well, your parents are here? How old are you? You know, I'm like, 13. And they're like, okay, well, how many classes are you taking? I'm like, well, this is my first class ever. And that was when I was in community college taking introductory English. My math skills were overcompensated. My English skills were horrible. And my speech skills were right behind it, pretty horrible. And so I took a lot of remedial speech classes and English classes to make up for my lack thereof of ability to write and speak at that time. So, oh,
interesting. I would never know that from you now, but that's also something that's not all that unusual. I mean, like the smartest kid that I knew in college who was just literally like genius level. Like I could not believe this guy's intellect. Very low on the social skills, you know?
Yeah. To the point of, like severe suicidal depression. And so for me, like my social anxiety and my Asperger's and all of that kind of just coalesced into like a storm around like age 16 or 17. And that's when mushrooms were available. I didn't look for mushrooms. Someone gifted me mushrooms and that changed everything for me. But it was a dark, like 4 or 5 years until that point.
Oh, so let's talk about those years. So you started community college when you were 13.
Yeah, actually earlier than that, because I was a dual credit student. So I always tell folks like 11 or 12, that's when I officially started, because I started taking dual credit classes at that time that counted towards my high school curriculum as well. And I had a whole several years where I was just doing upper placement classes and just testing out of Calc 1, testing out of Calc 2. CLEP test, you know, and all of the entry level tests to get into college at that time. I know I was the youngest dual credit student, so in that college system at that time, like I think 11 was the youngest that they had had. I'm sure they've had much younger than that by now, but it made me feel good, like I was doing something. And going to private college wasn't until I was like 15. Going to SMU. I spent almost 3.5, almost 4 years at Collin County Community College, and then I went to SMU.
Wow. So, I mean, that's kind of an interesting double-edged sword. On the one hand, that you clearly must have known that you were different from most other kids, and then you're in these college classes where everybody else is older than you, and that's just going to reinforce that, which is then going to create more social isolation for yourself and even more pressure to how do I get along with
yeah well people. For me, it was like most of my friends were your age. Most of my friends were over 35, and so it was all adults like finishing their education and stuff. And so I had a whole group of friends, you know, a lot of them I don't really keep in touch with anymore. Like some of them I think I'm still in touch with, like my friend Bobby, but I got to see them dealing with their regular lives. You know, I was like, well, if they're doing it, then I can do it too. You know, let me get a job. Let me, you know, make some money. Let me start trading stuff around on Craigslist. I remember by the time I was, you know, a teenager, I already had my first moped. I traded someone on a Sega Saturn for a Pep Boys moped, had my own set of wheels. It was 49cc. So in the state of Texas, it was legal for me to drive. You know, I was, a minor driving a vehicle, put the title in my name and everything, you know. Because I have friends around me who did stuff like that. You know, they flipped cars and mopeds. I eventually flipped my MacBook for my first motorcycle, you know. And it was just part of it, you know, part of what came with being young and with a group of much older people. And, you know, that was part of how I've developed over the years, is just having a really supportive group of professors, you know, really supportive group of administrative people and peers, you know, who have taken me aside and given me novel ideas or talked to me about really weird stuff. I remember being in college and spending most of my time in Bridwell School of Theology, reading all of these old Vedic texts. And that's when, like, it finally started occurring to me, okay, entheogenic plants play a part in human consciousness and development. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was, like, that was pretty much all I wanted to study. And I was studying astrophysics at the time, doing variable star research. So I, you know, had all these texts, you know, some of them that were super duper old that I couldn't even take out of the library. And I rushed over to my advisor's office and I was like, okay, I think I want to do research on consciousness as a state of matter for the rest of my career. And he looks at me, it's like, Bridwell and Hamilton don't work together. You can't do a research study, an engaged learning project with the School of Theology and the School of Sciences. That's not going to work. They're not ready for that yet.
Yeah.
And that broke my little heart. And I was like, okay, well, if you won't let me do it, then I'm going to do it on my own. And that's kind of been a lot of what fueled my early years of taking higher doses and exploring concepts of physics that at one point make sense as theories, but have really a lot of holes that can be poked in them on an actual literal level. You know, the theory of relativity, the universal theorem, these are all things that hold their weight. And then something like string theory comes along and it's like, you know, what if this is the new theorem, you know, then something like quantum entanglement comes along. I remember just reading last week that some of the first experiments proving quantum entanglement is real have been done. You know, you go to physics.org and you'll find like all these stories about quantum states and the ability for us as researchers to come up with more sensitive technology. And I would beg to differ that the most sensitive technology that can be made is biological technology. Because biological technology is paired with something of a quantum computer, which is the human brain, which can hold terabytes, hundreds of terabytes of information, and a substrate that's not static, it's gelatinous, you know? So time and energy move differently through that substrate just because of how the material of our brains is made. And so doing mushrooms and thinking about particle physics and quantum physics was and is a hobby of mine. I don't think about it so much because I've kind of settled on something that makes sense to me based on my combined experiences. And I still haven't found a way to make that a theoretical formula because it's something that is putting letters to something on that kind of scale seems really futile and useless. You know, I think that just like in the movie Lucy, like how Lucy's sitting there saying that humans are trying to create a scale based around their limited concept of how finite reality is, 1 + 1 = 2, you know, but when you get to a quantum level, 1 + 1 really does not equal 2. 1 + 1, there's no solid one. You can't ever get to a level of one because of how infinitesimal, you know, there are characteristics of an object that involve its mass being something that is vibrationally alterable. So if you change the vibration of that object, then maybe it becomes 0.99999. And then 1 + 1 is all broken from there. It's not actually measurable, you know, mass and matter as we see it is energy in motion. But there's energy that is stabilized into material forms and how we perceive it as being, you know, just sitting there and not moving is not really true. If you're to look at it under an electron microscope, that thing would be moving all over the place because of the vibration of the seismic waves coming from the Earth's crust because of the fact that it's just molecules that are constantly vibrating, being held together, you know, by this force of attraction. And honestly speaking, I think that we've got a long way to go before physicists have anything that I'm really interested in hearing about based on what I've observed as a human being, you know?
Wow. Oh. Wow. There's just so much in there, Acacia. But if we could, if you wouldn't mind sharing more about it, you mentioned this on the stage at Sanctum, and you mentioned it again here now, that sort of your first introduction to high-dose mushrooms came when you were feeling suicidal. I was wondering if you'd be willing to share more about that and how that came into your life and what shifted at that point.
Well, you know, I was kind of at that point where I really didn't believe in anything like spiritual. Like I had dreams and I've always been a dreamer, as in dreaming for the purpose of escapism, you know, and creating reality outside of my dream realm. And so I didn't really know that was a thing at the time. Lucid dreaming or dream yoga is something that just spontaneously arose to me when I was a little kid, and I kept up with it until, you know, I was a teenager. It got harder as a teenager, but I couldn't really place why it got harder. Of course, crappy relationships could have something to do with it. I was in a really bad relationship as an underage minor. And, you know, I had these pictures, and I took them to an Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation, like, rainbow gathering. And, you know, at the early rainbow gatherings, there's always some elders and there's always some underage kids wandering around, you know, probably getting high on whippets somewhere in a corner. You know, it's like there was a couple of teenagers, but it was mostly older people. And the older people saw me, kind of how I was moving around the campfire. You know, it would be like if someone in the psychedelic community went to like a camp out and there's people on mushrooms and then there's someone having a really hard time at the camp out. I didn't understand that they were actually going to care about me. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that there would be like a mutual communication. I was just sitting there with pictures burning them in the fire, you know, and I was like disrupting people's vibe. They're like, well, what's going on? I'm like, my life's over. You know, I fucking hate being alive. And that led to my boyfriend talking to eventually who became one of my early teachers of mycology. And he had some mushrooms, some Pinellas Hawaii that he wanted to test. He was like, well, it's her birthday, isn't it? How old are you? I'm like, I'm 16. He's like, okay, well, how about this? Come over to my house. I'll drive your motorcycle down the mountain. I don't want you driving through this mud. So he packed up my motorcycle, put on the back of his truck, and drove downtown Houston. So I drove on the back with my ex-partner at the time, Osiris. We pulled up at Bro's house, and we walk into his house, and he's got like all these sunshine, UV reactive tapestries on the wall, and like all this DJ equipment and stuff. And I'm just like, who is this guy? This is really weird, because I'd never been in like a psychedelic space before. So seeing lights and colors and, you know, like people have mandalas on the wall. I'm like, why do they got all this stuff? You know, this is really freaking weird. And so we sat down in this guy's kitchen. He has a really cute cat. Comes around, hands my boyfriend at the time like a bag of an unfathomable substance. Like, now we know what mushrooms look like. But back then it was just kind of like a ball of gunk if it actually came from somewhere fresh. So it just looked like a ball of black stuff.
Yeah.
In like a dime bag, like all twisted up, like real drugs, you know? You know, he was like, okay, well, I'm going to take you to the park and we're going to eat some chocolate and you're going to have a good time. And I'm like, okay, well, I trust you. And so we drove on our motorcycles. We had two different kinds of motorcycles. He had a Honda, I had a Suzuki. And I made it to the Houston Museum of History, and I ate some mushrooms on the lawn. And I didn't really understand that you were supposed to take mushrooms indoors. No one told me anything. I hadn't done any research. And I just, it felt like the most natural thing. It really did. It felt like somebody just took all of the anxiety and, you know, just aired it out, like just ironed out my emotions. And I felt really warm and fuzzy and happy. And I just laid down on the grass. And for the first time, I actually felt the grass, like in years, you know, and I really tapped into my smell. My sense of smell was heightened. I could smell the earth. I was sitting there sniffing leaves for I don't know how long, like a weirdo. I ran across the lawn, started hugging trees. The trees were forming faces. The faces were lovingly communicating with me. And it felt like I was back at 5 years old again or 4 years old again, like, but without anyone to tell me, oh no, don't do that. That's weird. Oh no, don't go over there and lay there. That's weird. People are going to look at you. And of course, you know, there were other people at the park. And I remember seeing a group of what I knew as homeschool moms, the long skirts and the mushroom haircuts gave it away. So I started like making a beeline across the lawn, and I finally ended up like by the looking pool area. There's this long rectangular pool, that, you know, it has some fish in it and stuff, but I made it to these mounds in front of the pool, and I started seeing, you know, vivid hallucinations of different buildings that look like something from Egypt, but not Egyptian per se, you know, just really elaborate and ornate doors and walls. And I was like, are you seeing this? And my boyfriend was like, no, I'm not seeing anything. I'm like, there's some kind of temple there. I just called it a temple. I was like, there's something there, but I don't have a key yet. And I just walked away and I didn't think about it anymore. And, you know, later on, like, you know, other trips made more sense of that first trip for me. I encountered that space many, many more times. But it was never like the first time, you know, and I think that's because Pinellas, Hawaii are not something that you can just get a lot of times. I think Pinellas works better for me for some reason, just because, you know, I doing the history and doing the digging, you find out that on the island of Hawaii, there are a lot of acacia groves and, you know, mushrooms that are grown on DMT containing plants are sometimes stronger than mushrooms that are just grown on rye grain or substrate. You know, just because of the tryptophan, the tryptamines break down into the foliage and the mushroom's a scavenger. And so it's going to scavenge those particles and make whatever it's going to make out of them, you know?
Yeah. So it sounds like that first experience really just essentially brought you into presence of being able to be where you were. And you didn't throw up any barriers, any self-conscious barriers to, oh no, don't smell that plant. Don't hug that tree. Don't quote unquote look weird. Just let yourself experience it. And so it really brought you into that just place of immediacy.
Yeah. And of course that was really difficult for me because a couple of weeks later, months later, I ended up going into military based training. And so it was going from that, and dressing like a hippie and having different stones. And then I realized that the stones I had been wearing had meanings, and it made everything that I had been curious about practical. Like, I liked stones. I didn't know why I liked holding stones. I didn't know why things happened when I put them under my pillow. I took mushrooms and started looking into the stones and realizing that there were properties vibrationally that were beneficial to me energetically, and that they were communicatable. Information from my physical or mental space could penetrate into the energy of the stone somehow. And I started studying that process, you know, just experientially holding different stones, finding out what it is that I'm feeling, writing down what I'm feeling. And then when I went into the military, you know, I took one of my stones in as a religious object, you know, because they had just started offering Buddhist and pagan services for airmen at that time. And I went to the pagan service proudly. And, you know, my earliest encounter with like spirituality beyond Christianity was trying to join the International Order of Bards and Ovades on the internet, like at age 10, and learning about the elements and reverencing the elements and stuff. Of course, you know, I didn't talk about it, but I was a huge fan of Druidism and Druidry. And I studied a lot. When I was in the military, I'd pick the mind of the student leader who would bring rocks and he'd bring pentagrams and stuff. And he'd have us all stand outside on the tarmac holding hands, visualizing white light coming into our heads. And I had, you know, that was one of my first experiences spiritually in the military.
And what brought you to the military in the first place?
Student loan debt. Oh, you know, yeah. They said that they'd pay for my PhD, and I was a senior in college and I had run out of money. It was 5 years in. And, that was a huge driving factor was I felt like I failed my parents because they took out these student loans they expected me to pay back. And, for astrophysics, your degree is almost worthless unless you have a PhD, even the most basic of jobs I wasn't qualified for. And in astrophysics, like working at a telescope laboratory. And so because I couldn't do research in what I wanted to do research in, I was kind of sequestered to variable star research, which studies two systems that are actually scraping against each other and colliding into supernova. These variable stars are like two suns or two brown dwarfs or a brown dwarf and a red dwarf. And their gravitational pull basically sucks themselves together until they explode. And so that's the kind of stuff I was studying in college, you know, and I had some star discoveries, you know, as a teenager, but I thought astrophysics was going to be more stargazing and less spending time on Linux and IDL, you know, and it didn't inspire me that much anymore. And so I went into the military hoping that I could get some money, and they changed the law when I was in the military to make it so that people who went to private schools couldn't get access to the GI Bill. And the Hazelwood Act for Texas wouldn't work because I was going to a private school. And so it was like, I went through training and I went through my seasoning days and I got into a car accident before I got to finish my technical school. So eventually that was a moot point. But the day I got into the car accident, I got engaged to my best friend. And my wife at that time, Melody Lewis, was helping me to, or encouraging me to go back to the mushrooms. And so I ended up introducing her to psilocybin mushrooms, and we started doing doses of mushrooms together after I got kicked out of the military.
Mm. So were these also high dose mushroom experiences, or had you really looked into that much at this point?
I had, but I was still at like, I started at 7 grams. So I was hovering between 7 grams and 10 grams for a really long time. Like, I didn't get brave enough to do like 15 grams of mushrooms until me and my wife had been together like almost a year. So I was like 21, 22 years old. And it's been working, between age 21 and 25, I worked my way all the way up to 20 grams and then past 20 grams and back down and back up. But I believed I should take like several months in between because I kept getting headaches if I did too many mushrooms or didn't take enough time. So I started studying different ways to optimize my physical body's interactions on whatever dose I would take. So if I was getting headaches and back pain, I started studying kidney issues and dehydration and different ways to nourish my physical body so that I could endure those really long 8-hour trips without coming out feeling like I've been beat with bricks, you know? Yeah. I remember I had one trip where I actually had been going to a Hare Krishna ashram and learning about Shaivism and Hare Krishna tradition. And I came back and I took a mushroom trip and I saw Shiva in my trip. And when I saw him come through, it was kind of like I had gone so far out there that, or I guess you could say so in a certain direction in my visions that the last thing that ever existed was this personification of Shiva, was this pre-atomic form of Shiva, because I kept trying to get closer and closer and closer to a molecular form. How can I meditate on getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller? And smaller and smaller and smaller I got closer to this personality of Shiva. And when I saw it, it started communicating to me, well, you can't die. You're eternal. Your soul is eternal. You know, basically everything that makes you up also makes up everything else in the world. And it's also you. And, you know, I'm basically going to break all of your bones and realign your body so that you won't have any pain in this part of your body. And I was like, okay, well, that sounds fun. Have at it. And I remember that was the first time I came out of a trip and I was aware that I looked different. And other people could see that I looked different. And I was kind of disturbed by that. I was like, wait, what just happened to me? You know, I met this Hindu god and it told me that it was going to help me live a better life. Okay, that's something that I never had happen. And so I started, you know, studying different mantras and studying different traditions like Kashmiri Shaivism that centers around Shivaic worship. And it's not really worship, but more like self-realization or self-actualization, yeah, that they're these forms of Shiva. And so that took me deeper because Shiva is a devotee of Krishna. So I was like, so if I met Shiva, then who's Krishna? You know? Then I dedicate like 6 months time to being a devotee to Krishna. And I recognize certain weird things would happen when I would say a Hare Krishna mantra. Someone would immediately appear to me within like 2 to 4 hours of me saying 108 rounds of that mantra who needed help. Specifically help that sometimes I could only help them with. Like one lady had just had her first mushroom trip or wanted to know something about mushrooms in the supermarket line right after I said the mantra. And this was like 2016, 2017. This was before like it was really acceptable to really even say the M word, like in Tucson, Arizona. It was kind of like a taboo for a while, I know, to just be talking about psychedelics openly, you know? Yeah. Now people just run up to you like, oh, do you do mushrooms? Like back then it was like, no, we don't,
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you know, you know, but we're not going to say it because we don't want to get got. I noticed moments that seemed like I was entangled with this force, but it was difficult for me to communicate with it. And so I started listening to podcasts and reading books about Prabhupada talking to Christian monastics, like a Catholic priest, and saying, okay, well, Krishna is like Jesus to us and Christ to you guys. He's someone who is a divine personality of the Godhead, not an actual physical person. And it turns out the two religions had a lot in common. So I was like, well, am I not able to access Source because I don't like Christianity? Mm. Let me go ahead and dive into my own belief system. And I found out that I had a lot of negative bias against the concept of God or a God at all.
Yeah.
Really. And I think that was really more like the atheistic part of me, just really wanting to scientifically explain it. And the closest I could get to scientifically explaining it was like the Vedic stuff. So I felt like my mushroom trips were more themed around those beliefs of, okay, well, God can't exist outside of a scientific explanation. And so the mushroom was showing me something that was in line with that set of beliefs. And so I started attacking those beliefs and taking those apart. And I got to the point where I just didn't trust having beliefs that weren't heartfelt. So if I was just believing something because I was uncomfortable, I would take mushrooms and just dig to the bottom of why I was feeling uncomfortable with it. And I'd find out there was really no reason for me to be uncomfortable with it. I just needed to let it go if it didn't really resonate with me. And so there was a lot of unmasking going on for me at that time. With the beginning, higher doses, like 8 grams, 10 grams, really trying to figure out why I thought that something was or wasn't true, and allowing myself to observe whether it was or wasn't true for myself on an objective level. And then testing it multiple times to see if, okay, you know, this is something that's applicable to me, you know, not just my own bias. You know, and that had to do a lot with even sexuality. Like, I'm attracted to this kind of individual, this kind of man, this kind of eye color, this kind of hair color, this kind of build because of these social standards. This isn't just something that I've set. I need to take this apart in my head because these thoughts have been groomed over, you know, over a decade of me seeing certain things on television and in magazines I found attractive, and then reinforcing the level of attractiveness for me. Let me just go ahead and become more unorthodox. Like, let me look at someone on a soul level rather than on a physical level. And that changed my relationship with my partner at the time to a more positive relationship even, because it helped me to see that really what I was looking for were specific characteristics rather than physical characteristics, energetic characteristics. And luckily, I was with someone who had both. Yeah. So it wasn't like, okay, I need to break up with this person. I've, you know, just gotten with this person because I think they're hot. You know, I'm really shallow. It was I'm really shallow type trip. Let me go cultivate depth. But, you know, it quickly turned into, you were supposed to go through this process so that you could better understand loving yourself and your own characteristics, how to build your own character. What are your foundational beliefs? You know? And so I was like, well, I don't want to hurt anyone and I don't want to mess up anyone else's life. And then that started me researching into different foundational laws of core belief, like the 42 laws of Ma'at. That was a big one for me, because I grew up with a huge fixation on different Egyptian hieroglyphs and architecture, but I really didn't understand any esoteric meaning to it at all. When I took mushrooms, it opened me up to exploring those areas. So I remember one trip I said, well, what if I behave according to these laws of Ma'at? What's going to change about the way that I trip? I just did an experiment. And I did this with Hinduism, Kemeticism, Ifa, and Buddhism. And I'm still working through the Buddhist side. Not there yet, but that's kind of the point. yeah, there's no there to get to. Be here now type
yeah.
mentality. But on my way to get to Buddhism, I really loved looking at the different gods and goddesses of each do not. So do not take someone else's wife. Do not litter. Do not lie. All these things. So I held myself in that way. And I still strive to hold myself in that way to those higher standards. Because the next trip that I had, I saw something that looked kind of like the Eye of Ra. And it's just that big Egyptian eye. And it appeared inside of a mandala that was not Egyptian themed at all. It was just one of those sunshine UV reactive mandalas. You know, I picked up the idea from that guy who gave me my first mushroom trip. And I felt my body get disintegrated through this eye. And my heart was literally weighed in this trip. And I felt like all the behaviors in my past that were not in alignment turned into black ash. And the things that were, like, according to positive attributes, turned into this gold. And this gold, or this spiritual gold, started oscillating. And I traveled through it like a DNA helix into this reality that looked like it was in the future. And when I say it looked like it was in the future, it's just like everything that we think of that makes this material world was made of an etheric crystal holographic texture instead of what you see, you know, like the wood walls. It was made of like clear crystal turquoise light.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to go and hang out in this world for a little while before I got put back into my body. And, you know, for me, it was like winning an award in a dimension that you don't think exists and talking to people who also don't exist. It makes you wonder, am I going crazy? You know, is this real life? And I remember Kalindi saying something like, if you think it's real, if you feel it's real, it's real. You know, and for me, it felt real. And so I started doing research on time travel, you know, and I started finding accounts of people who had taken San Pedro and trip reports where they had encountered something like time travel. What was interesting about that trip is that I had been working with San Pedro. And so I correlated it to the San Pedro that I felt like I had moved in time. And, yeah, you know, I take all my trips with a grain of salt. You know, I don't take it as like, okay, this is what happened. For me, it taught me a lot about the aspects of immortality being correlated to mortality in the form of morals. As in, your morals make you immortal. Like, even if you die right now, the principles that you stood for will always hopefully exist, even throughout time. And so if you behave in these ways that are really upright and upstanding, even if your name is not remembered, you can live on through the practice of being a good person itself, you know, even thousands of years in the future, you know, and that kind of just stuck with me. Hopefully there are good people still in the future, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh said, I am not my body. You know, if I'm to be found everywhere, it is within Zen practice. And I felt that, you know, on a very integral level. And so it's something that I keep close to my heart.
Oh, again, there's a lot there. I'm just going to let the audience digest all that. I'm going to redirect us just a little bit here. So it sounds like a lot of what you've shared here is very kind of like with your studies in school and all that, very self-directed, that you're interested in it, you're diving in, you're going as far as you can.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if there's anything you could share along the lines of, I think that, African Americans are playing more of a role in the quote unquote psychedelic movement these days, that there's more interest there, but I think it's been, it hasn't really been talked about too much. So I'm just curious if you found community with other individuals within the African American community, or was this more in the psychedelic or hippie community? Was this more individual? And then I'm curious about how you originally connected with Kalindi, which just to share how I connected with Kalindi. It was actually through Darren LeBaron in London. who I guess we could call him an African Englishman. I don't know what term they would use over in England, but he said that he learned about me through Kalindi, and so I learned about Kalindi through him, and that was maybe back in 2011 or something like that. And then I learned about Kalindi kind of developing community in Detroit and bringing African Americans into working with psychedelics. So I'm just curious how you made that connection, and there was a lot of things that you just shared through those experiences that reminds me of conversations I had with Kalindi. So that's all a roundabout way, just kind of asking if you have anything to say about the African American community and psychedelics, and then the connection with Kalindi and his work.
Well, you know, I was sitting on a park bench with my boyfriend watching one of his like 2012 lectures on YouTube and thinking to myself, okay, this guy is full of crap. but then he made the mistake of saying my name correctly, which was Acacia. He was talking about the acacias in his lecture. And I was like, okay, well, I've never heard anyone lecture about that. And then I found out, you know, that there was other content. And I was like, okay, well, that's what I want to know about. I want to know about the acacias. I want to know about the acacia tree and the DMT and the trips, you know, in Ethiopia and the Numba dance. I want to know about that stuff because that's like actually connected to me somehow. And I started following him under a fake name on Facebook for a couple of years. And I was under Kaylin Mosshart. And I chose the name Kaylin because I was like, oh, well, you know, I like this name. And I think it was because Kai Wingo was giving her first lecture. I was like, I want to be her when I grow up or like her when I grow up.
Yeah.
And I was a huge fan. We just had the Women in Entheogens conference in honor of Mama Kai Wingo. She was one of Kalindi's partners who was at one of the Reagan conventions. And she was a huge inspiring figure for me as like an African-American woman lecturing. And so for me, like, first it was just commenting on some of Kalindi's posts. And then he made the mistake of posting his personal phone number on Facebook one time.
Kalindi?
He never did it again. Yeah, he never did it again. He's like, call me if you want to talk. I'm like, okay. So I saved his number in my phone. And then like a year or two later, like around 2017, 2016, I called him at the peak of one of my trips because I had done Syrian rue and 14 grams of mushrooms or 14 or 16. I don't remember. It was in that range. And I remember I had driven to Texas for my birthday to get mushrooms from the guy who first gave me mushrooms because he was always reliable and I really didn't trust anyone in the community. So I went like 14 hours and I drove back home to New Mexico and I was sitting in a cabin in the middle of nowhere tripping balls, and I saw these Sierpinski triangles, these fractal triangles open up, and I got smaller and smaller and smaller until it was like I came out on the other side in the macro realm back in my body, and I was like, why doesn't he talk about this stuff? If he's taking high doses, why don't you talk about the infraparticle and like the submolecular? Because I'd already been exploring that. And I called him, he said, call me when you come down. And then like the first conversation we had was me giving him the download on my massive trip report, and he said, well, tell me what happens next time. And it became like a 6-year long friendship until he passed away, you know, just calling, and eventually it became more of a teacher-student relationship, but I didn't really see it that way. I saw him kind of as my friend until he started asking me to write essays about stuff. That was when he came out with the transdimensional crystals, and he said, well, because I gave him such a hard time, I told him I could buy a piece of quartz anywhere for $2. Why would I pay $40 for a piece of quartz? Because he had these stones he had taken up on 30 grams of mushrooms and embedded his own maps into, and I was like, that's not possible. That's some BS, you know? I don't believe in that. You know, again, very skeptical, very science minded there. And he said, well, just try it. You know, if it doesn't work, you know, you don't ever have to talk to me or buy anything. You know, just he didn't even pressure me to buy anything. I'm the one who asked him and then got in his inbox telling him how stupid an idea it was. And I got it in the mail. And, you know, for the first year, I was like, yeah, it's not doing anything. And then one day I took a 5-gram trip and the light in the room was just low enough where I could see the crystal. And it happened. The thing happened where it came to life like a really amazing ornate crystal gate opened up out of the stone, spontaneous of me thinking about it. I was like, this thing's not going to work. That's where my head was at. And then all of a sudden it asked me, what's the password? And I'm like, okay, it's Kalindi playing some tricks on me, isn't it? And I tell her, I don't know the password. It says, well, you don't know because you're distracted. And so I sat there thinking, okay, I was in a loop. I go, okay, I don't know the password. Crap, I'm not doing this. Oh, okay, I'm doing this. What's the password? Oh, crap, I'm not doing this. And I was like, that is a distraction. And I just stopped. And then I stopped, like, levels into my thought processes. Like pressing on air brakes, riding a semi. That, like, my brain at that time was a semi going in this loop, and I just had to stomp the brakes and just, like, grit my teeth and then, like, make the thought stop. And I was holding the stone, and my hands were, like, sweating. And I had the imprint of the stone in my head, in my hand. And I thought, forgive everyone, and you'll be forgiven. And it just kind of just slipped, like a wet fart. Just came right out. And I was like, okay, well, forgive everyone. That's hard. I don't want to do that. And I was like, well, if you want access to these dimensions, you've got to do that first. And so a lot of crying, and almost like several exorcisms later, I felt these personalities of mine that were convincing me to hold on to the past, like coming up, like lust, like the seven deadly sins, like lust, gluttony, greed, anger, hatred, envy, like all these spirits. And one by one, I had to basically fight them in order to tell it, no, I decide if I want to let this go. If I want to let this go, then I'm going to let this go. I'm choosing to forgive. I'm choosing not to be angry about forgiving. I'm going to let this go. And so it was just hours of that. And then the stone said, okay, well, now you can come on in, basically. And at that point, I was like, well, it was like, where do you want to go? And I'm looking at the stone like, well, where can I go? And it said, well, do you want to go to the village? It's like, okay, take me to the village. And at that moment, it's like I automatically left my body and went to a predefined point that had already been created. That was a village with their kids running. Like literally my playlist was on auto, right? And my playlist went to a village with children after that happened. And I started hearing kids. And I was like, what the heck? And it was my phone playing this African village song. And I could see the kids like marching, like Maasai children marching with these large arrow spears. And, you know, they were just marching down and having a good time. And I was in this river of water that wasn't water. It was like etheric light, rainbows of light that was just washing over my head. And I sat up in the river and I saw a giant tree next to me besides the river. And I just kind of scooted myself. I wasn't actually physically moving my body, but in this space, I was able to move myself out of the water and sit under this tree. And there were so many books and so much like, there were interfaces to work with. I'll just put it that way. And I just grabbed a book and I sat there and I read this book of just almost like food for the soul. It felt like I was nourishing and repairing my soul on a really deep level. And I just sat there for what felt like forever. I came back and I literally called up one of my best friends and I said, I've been gone for 6 months. Because it didn't feel like I had been gone. It was like no other trip I had ever had. I felt like I'd been gone for years. Like I wanted to say 1,000 years. And that was the start of my first time in the interdimensional village. And I called Kalindi. I was like, I told him what happened. He's like, well, I want you to write an essay about it. And then that's when I got the more teacher side of Kalindi was after that. Yeah.
Nice. You know, I just wanted to comment on the password of, it was forgive everyone.
Yep. And you'll be forgiven.
Well,
yeah. And I was really holding some stuff against my ex at that time. So that was like right after like a bad breakup. And I really wanted to do some horrible things. Like malice was in my heart.
Yeah.
It tells me that like that was a interesting
Yeah, that's a hard one. It reminds me of, I wouldn't have called it a password, but I think that's a good way maybe of describing it. It was kind of early on in my own process as I was really opening up and transforming, but I got the message of love everyone without exception. And that was a hard one for me because at that time in my life, there were some people that I was holding a lot of strong grudges against.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, the people I don't even know or whatever, but it was just insistent. Love.
But it's a fractal.
Everyone. Yeah.
It's fractal. Like what that is like one of those fractal keys. Like yeah. You can take it anywhere and it's still gonna work. Love everyone without exception. Forgive yeah. everyone and you'll be forgiven.
Yeah.
It's almost like saying the same thing a different way.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
It's
yeah.
a magical incantation, you know, and I don't even know if it was the crystal or that unlocked so much, but
yeah. Wow. Well, what a cool story. So then I know that you've mentioned that it was Kalindi who kind of pushed you into actually publicly speaking.
It was actually Mudu. Mudu is the one who put me up to the task of giving Baba a prompt to speak on. We were at Food of the Gods in 2018 and Mudu goes like, you got a lot of stories to tell. Why don't you come and lecture? I was like, I don't want to. He's like, you got to, come on. Like you should, like I'll go with you. So he like walked with me over to Kalindi. And Muda was like, I think she wants to speak at the conference. And I was just like, no. I mean, yeah. He was like, well, what are you going to talk about? And I'm like, well, I'll talk about quantum realities and femto-sized particles and the multiverse. And he's like, okay. So I was like, you're really going to let me talk about that? He was like, sure. It's like, okay. And I was like, oh, crap. What have I gotten myself into? Now I actually have to like make sense of what I've been seeing and stuff and write it all down, like actually give a lecture. And I did, you know, but YouTube took it off of, they said I violated the terms. I think because I still look like a 12-year-old, they thought maybe there was a child talking about drugs or they're just being jerks. They took my first lecture off of YouTube, but it was on YouTube for some time. 2018 Detroit Entheogenic Conference in the fall was my first lecture, first official lecture.
Yeah. So you're obviously giving a lot of talks now, but did you kind of maintain that momentum or did you give a talk and then back away or how was
that? I tried to like not do it again.
Yeah.
Like I just wanted to go back to Mexico and then I had some trips in Mexico that told me like, okay, you got to do this. Like hundreds of people came up to me like after the Detroit conference and, you know, had things to say or they were inspired and I didn't expect that much positive feedback. And it said, well, the mushroom basically told me in my trips, like for everything that I've given you, give back to me. So I was like, okay, so it's like reciprocation. It's like, yeah, like you've got to reciprocate. You've got to share your knowledge or else you're going to lose your knowledge and, you know, that'll be your fault. So I'm like, okay, well, if I don't want to lose my knowledge, then I got to lecture or write about it.
yeah. That's another one that I can definitely identify with. And again, going through my own process is like, shit, I've got to share this and might rub some people the wrong way. Might not like actually what I have to share, but it's like, this is what I've received. So I've got to share it. And so,
yeah, I think I'm in my Bernie Mac era. I don't care if you don't like me. I like me.
Yeah.
That's my mood right now.
Nice. Well, I'm glad that you did, and I'm glad that you're continuing to do so. I just think that you have such an important perspective. We don't find many people trained in astrophysics who are involved in the psychedelic space. I mean, maybe you know more because you're into astrophysics, but I haven't met too many. Probably the closest I've ever gotten is I actually did an integration call with somebody who was a scientist on the International Space Station. And that was pretty interesting to me to talk to that guy. But I don't know a lot of people who are into astrophysics. And somebody was just asking me the other day, like, well, who are the scientists and physicists and astrophysicists? Who are the ones that are working with psychedelics and investigating it from this angle? I was like, well, gosh, I don't know. I mean, there's Acacia, but I don't know. I mean, so do you know
there's
of others?
There's a lot more of us, like, at CERN. Like, it's common knowledge that folks at CERN, like, my whole graduating class ended up at NASA or CERN from college. I'm pretty much the only one who didn't get a job at one of those two places. And it's not, I didn't even apply. I wasn't really interested, but, you know, word travels, you know, through the grapevine. Yeah. They're doing LSD over there. You know, they're a bunch of hippies on the low. And that does fit the profile of the young people that I went to college with. Of course, I don't ask them those questions, because it's kind of like, it could mess up their job if they get found out, but it does happen. And for me, like, I feel like I'm a broken astrophysicist, because I didn't get a PhD. I didn't graduate officially. You know, I did almost 6 years in college, and I have over 100 credit hours. But at the same time, for me to graduate in a distinguished honors way, because I was a Hamilton scholar and a McNair scholar, I would have to probably take a whole bunch of stuff, because it's been over 10 years since I was in college. But I say, like, for me now, I'm a visionary researcher and just a continuous learner. I'm always going to be a continuous learner. And I feel like the reason why I created my school, Divine Master Alchemy, is for people like me who want to actually go to, like, an undergraduate, try to create an undergraduate environment for people to study religion, spirituality, herbalism, medical science, and quantum physics as a multidisciplinary approach. And that's what I'm attempting to create. I took a year off from teaching this year, but it was 3 years teaching since I got the tap on the shoulder. Hey, Acacia, you need to start a school. And that was from Kalindi saying, I want you to keep teaching. I want you to keep writing, and I want you to keep sharing what you're doing. And I have.
Yeah, well, that to me sounds like the wave of the future, to quote the Big Lebowski. Because, you know, things are changing. And I think that there will come a point where it is socially acceptable for physicists and philosophers and scientists to say, yeah, and I'm doing research with these psychedelics, and I'm investigating my questions with psychedelics.
I think it's going to be essential in the future, actually. I have a prediction. I think that as mushrooms become less taboo, it's going to become a researcher's quintessential tool, no matter what discipline.
You know, my background is in religious studies, and I've always insisted, like, I wish everyone in religious studies would spend some time with psychedelics. I would love anybody who claims to have a master of divinity or a doctorate in divinity, you know, take some 5-MeO, and then let's talk.
It would test their applied learning of of what they say that they are the experts on or study, because I feel like a lot of people who talk about God honestly have had very limited experiences with God, and if they say that that's what they love doing, then put your money where your mouth is.
Put up or shut up. Well, I definitely, I want to return to Divine Mastery Alchemy, but I want to get a little bit more of your story, because I love listening to your stories and hearing about your life. So how did you hook up with Mike Crowley? When did that occur?
Well, actually, my wife was a big fan of his work. My wife was named Mike Lewis, and Mike was like, oh, another Mike wrote a book. Oh, my God. Secret Drugs of Buddhism was our household staple from 2015 onward. And Mike knew Kalindi, and Kalindi did give a couple lectures about some of the Tibetan Vajrayana tantric traditions, some of the mandalas that would come to life. And I was always curious about mandalas and stuff.
Yeah.
Because of how I was brought into the psychedelic world. And I didn't contact Mike. I was actually, after my wife died, we had both planned to initiate into Buddhism in 2023 or in 2022. She passed away in 2021. And I feel like, you know, who she was as a compassionate, forgiving, and kind figure, she helped me to apply a lot and integrate a lot of what I realized in my trips in real life. And she would have wanted to study under him. So the first opportunity I got after basically going and meditating at different Buddhist institutions, one of my friends said, hey, Lama Mike's going to be in Mill Valley. You want to go? And I was like, hell yeah, I want to go. And so me and my friend Tom the Buddhist, he used to work at Google, and my current partner and my coworker, we all went and piled up in her van, and we went to Mill Valley to watch Llama Mike give his lecture in a clothing store, no less. And I was really inspired. And I remember thinking before I went in there, I was like, let me go say hi to the old man. And I was like, why did I say that in my head? And I was like, okay, that's weird. Now I kind of refer to him as Lamala or the old man, you know, more consistently. But he's, you know, he's an inspiring, courageous, wise, witty figure in my life as a friend and as a root llama. I didn't expect him to choose me as a student. He just called me up one day, or no, he sent me a text on Messenger, and he said, well, when would you like to get initiated? This auspicious date is coming up. And I said, sure, I'll get initiated then. And I think I had sent him some tea in the mail because I had been studying for this whole year under a tea master where I live, Chinese traditional Chinese tea ceremony. And so I brought him some tea, and he gifted me a beautiful Buddha and a mala, and he gave me my Buddhist vows, and about to take more vows soon. But, you know, he's been someone to me as a botanist and as someone who initiated into Buddhism with an open mind and is a part of a lineage that has a history of working with psychedelics. It made me feel a whole lot better about entering the world of Buddhism while also being someone who occasionally works with psychedelics. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I don't work with them all the time, maybe like 3 big trips a year at max. But reading his book made so much more sense about some of the experiences I've been having, some of the more non-dual experiences especially. Mm. And, you know, some of the visualizations he's put me up to are so complex. I know that by the time I get done going through some of these trainings, I'm going to be a lot sharper and a lot more focused and dedicated of an individual. And I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah. And you see him somewhat regularly?
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw him this week or last week. I think I went up there on a Tuesday to bring him cat litter. but yeah, I go up and I make runs. Hopefully he'll be moving to the Bay Area so that he can continue to teach and have more students than the ones that will just drive up there.
Yeah, he's kind of out in the woods, isn't he?
Yeah, he's like 5 hours north of me in Oakland. So it's a drive, but I make it up there at least twice a month.
Yeah. So. Well, Mike is just a great guy. And actually, I've had both Mike and Kalindi here in Ashland for events that I've put on at the same time. And you even mentioned Kai, that it was really sad that it was all lined up to have Kai come and speak and also come out with Kalindi. And then she passed like just maybe even just a few weeks before the event.
I was trying to go to that Women in Entheogens that year. And so for me, I was like devastated. Like, cause that was going to be the time I got to meet her, and she passed away before I could even get a chance to meet her. So, yeah, I feel that.
Yeah. I did get a chance to meet her in London at Breaking Convention. And actually that year is kind of alternating between walking around and hanging out with Kalindi and walking around and hanging out with Mike. So that was my year at Breaking Convention. But both exceptional individuals. And I also wanted to ask you about Tom Lane, because it ties into another thing we've been talking about here on the podcast with these time persons. And I know that you're one of the individuals who've gotten to
I would try argue this. That Tom Lane's research goes beyond Aztec philosophy, but I won't say that on here. Because, you know, he's all about the facts and the anthropology, and I really respect that about him. You know, the avatars of Tian and Akadol and the Yodotono Mixtec Mayan codices are some of like his translations are some of my favorite because I've experienced the journey to the underworld as the Mayan Tlalamin priests would have, as far as chewing the mushroom without swallowing with honey, mm-hmm. and also doing the fasting with the cacao the day before. I will say that it's something that I think everyone's been through, perhaps on a high dose of mushrooms going to the underworld, but there are specific instructions, like when I'll just say, go ahead and buy the book, buy Secret Drugs of Buddhism, buy Psychedelic Buddhism, buy the Sacred Mushroom Rituals book by Tom Lane, because each one is a journey that has taken me years to really like grok, you know. And for Tom Lane, he is one of the most enthusiastic, positive individuals I know. Sometimes even like someone who will send you crazy memes just like the weirdest crap on Facebook Messenger. But traveling with him was a joy, you know, and I really like his interpretations of some of the stelas of Xochicalco and the Mayan rituals, because living in Mexico for me, I really want to honor the traditions of the mushroom even beyond modern shamanism, you know, all the way back to the roots of its original use for warriors. And he sent me a Quetzalcoatl coin after I'd complete my first trip with the Mayan codices. So, okay, now you've earned the right to be called Quetzalcoatl. And that was that, you know. I won't give too much else away, because for me, that's a very personal journey that I'm still on. You know, same with Buddhism, same. You know, for me, I'm full immersion, you know. I live what I study.
Yeah.
And I love what I study. And for me, all these systems stack and intersect and connect in a really amazing way. And so it doesn't really feel like I'm doing multiple things or going into multiple systems. It really feels like one thing with different colors.
Yeah.
And I'm just really excited, you know, to keep going down the rabbit hole.
Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and return to Divine Mastery Alchemy. Divine Master Alchemy.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us more about it and the germination of it and what it is. And it sounds like it's still going on. So how people could get
involved.
Me
and my wife started it like in 2017. Officially, my wife was a botanist, or someone who really loved plants. I won't say a botanist. She didn't go to college for it, but she knew almost every single plant by name and by smell and by taste from Pennsylvania coast. She grew up in Pennsylvania and was a rabbit breeder. And so she found ways to create organic superfoods for her rabbits. And that led into a lifelong passion of learning about plants. And so between me and her, she encouraged me to write down the plants that I used to treat my depression and my anxiety, and as well as my kidney issues and my sickle cell trait, and my endometriosis and fibroid tumors. I had so many health concerns at the beginning of me taking mushrooms that was physically very uncomfortable for me to work with mushrooms.
Yeah.
Because how much pain I was in. Just on a regular basis. I had drank a lot when I was depressed. I had smoked packs and packs and packs of cigarettes to the point that inside my lungs was just wrecked. I know that I'm a lot healthier now. I know I'm a lot happier now because of the work that we did with those plants as well as the mushroom. And the mushroom was not the solution to it, not the end-all solution. The neurological chemistry, learning how my brain works and the amino acids it needs, the hormones need to be functioning and balanced correctly. Learning traditional Chinese medicine with her was a joy, Ayurveda. We went into so many systems as researchers, me primarily as the researcher, because that's my background that I use in teaching from Divine Master Alchemy is my astrophysics research skills. Basically going through PubMed and JSTOR and academia, trying to find the best research articles on these plants on a medical scale, and then correlate them to the anthropological and mythological or spiritual roots of their years. And so when I teach about plants, I teach about not only my experience with them, but what the experience was for the ancients, whether that's Hindu plants, African plants, or Chinese medicine plants, or even Native American plants. And, you know, for me, I have my testament of how it worked or didn't work for me. And what the traditional rituals and rites are around their use. So I try to preserve the stories from a multitude of elders that I've had that taught me how to use the plant or taught me about it. And so I've got the oral tradition, the medical tradition, and the spiritual history of what this plant's for. So for instance, like take a plant that's one of my favorites, like intellect tree seed, which is just the seed part of the Celastris paniculatus plant. That goes back all the way to the term Jyotishmati, or the light time brain plant, and the Rig Veda and Vedic accounts of its use. I actually discovered the plant when I was trying to figure out ways to cure dementia. My grandmother died of dementia when I was, my great grandmother died of dementia when I was a young girl. And that broke my heart. I felt like no one should have to die like that, unaware of who they are, who they were. And so one of the first plants I've been studying, even since I was like, so I was about 15 or 16, was different plants to cure dementia. Cause I was determined if my mom ever showed signs, I would have a solution. Or if I ever showed signs, I would have a solution. And so a lot of my childhood reading about plants and botany has segued into my mushroom work and my research. And teaching for me, like when you think of divine master alchemy, it's really backwards for me, because it's the alchemy the masters use to access divinity or to maintain their connection to divinity. Mm. That's why I created that school. So alchemy, meaning it could be a combination of medical, scientific, mineralogy, holistic practitionership, and mathematics. You know, it's an alchemy of different disciplines of study that relate all to how one tonic or one herb connects to a million and one different things. And part of my passion was driven by doing research on this one plant called wild asparagus root, which is like the flying herb of the Tibetan monks. It's a oneirogen, but learning its chitavari in another language, learning that there are so many different grades of the root that are used for different purposes. And finding out that each plant that I knew of grows in a multitude of different countries, and each country has a different name and different traditional use for it. And so for me, I was like, well, how can I teach one plant if I don't teach the 360 degree, the ostrich feather, or the full realization of that one plant to a multitude of people, not just one group of people? Because I felt like that's what Google does. You Google a plant like wild asparagus root, you might find a little bit of how it's used in India, yeah. But you don't find anything about how it's used as a psychedelic in Tibet, you know, and that's glaring, you know, a glaring misstep on the part of the internet. But the internet is not the best research tool. We are really good researchers, though. So I created a 3D mind map multiverse for all the plants that I've studied and the different traditions that they connect to, and the traditional names of the rites and rituals, so that people can explore at their own pace, take a walk around the globe, and find out how many sacred or ethnobotanical plants are connected to these traditions that have been around for thousands of years, or even hundreds of thousands of years. And it's kind of like a smorgasbord for folks, because one week we might be talking about a day in the life of Maria Sabina, where we talk about the food that she would have eaten, the ritual instruments that would have been used, along with Copal, along with the symbology of the ritual instruments, and then going down into the culture of the Mazatec mushroom shaman, going through the book called The Mushroom Doctor. If you've never read Camelia Martinez's The Mushroom Doctor book, it's a really great book about the journey of other Mazatec practitioners in the area. And so you can understand more about the velada, the actual songs that Maria Sabina sings, and the significance of them to her. You know, so for me, it's not about giving, you know, like a 15-minute summary of a plant. It's a real researcher's course. You know, let's find out what food this group of people ate. Let's find out how climate changed. What was the geography like from 300 BC to 600 BC for the Nazca to become the Moche? And how did the pottery signify their move from San Pedro cactus to mushrooms with the changing climates? And did the combination of mushrooms and cactus create a whole nother cult movement? And what is the Chavin? You know, how many hundreds of species of San Pedro are there? How do you grow and germinate San Pedro? What are the dieta practices, and what current lineages are still around today for you to go and learn from? That's kind of the stuff I'm into.
Yeah. Wow. So this is something that people can still participate in? It's still
ongoing? Next year we're going to have a tea-themed spring semester where I'll have one of my team master and a chemist and a researcher who both work together. Mr. John, he's going to be teaching classes about the different time periods that these teas became well known, the roasting techniques, the phytochemistry, and the physiological benefit, as well as the history and the traditional use. And so because I've been studying tea for a year, I'm going to bring my teachers to come and teach the students so that they can kind of see how the dynamic is of in the field actually encountering people who also do the same kind of research that I do, multidisciplinary.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Awesome. Again, you are just a powerhouse. You've got so many interests, and I think you're doing an excellent job of just bringing them all together and doing something like really new, and it's really exciting.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
So, Acacia, you know, we're recording this, and it's going to be several weeks before it actually comes out, but I know you have some more speaking gigs, so where else are you going to be showing up?
Bayul Mushroom Retreat, Hamilton's Mushroom Retreat in Aspen, Colorado, the 10th through the 13th. November Spirit Medicine Conference in British Columbia, Vancouver. And even into next year, showing up at the Botanica Obscura Conference, the Poison Path Conference next year. So
cool.
There's more on that list, but I need to confirm and stuff. So.
Well, that's awesome. It's great that you're getting all these opportunities. And again, I'm glad that you were prodded to actually speak in public and start sharing, because you've obviously got a lot to share. And we need people who are smart and who know their shit and are willing to talk about it. And I'm happy to say that you're definitely one of those.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you'd want to share before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your afternoon?
The project in Oaxaca is still going forward with San Jose del Pacifico, with the we've been building a mycology center in Rancho Cerezol for the local population to utilize to further preservation of the rare psilocybin species that grow in the cloud forest there at high altitude. And so sometime next year, or at the end, probably in October this year, we're going to lead a nature walk. I'll be doing a master class with Fungi Academy in September on high dose mushroom use and how to build a modern strong mind to be able to handle those non-dual states of consciousness. And yeah, that's it. So Mycology Center is still going on, and a master class is coming up.
Awesome. So for people listening who'd like to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to find you and get
Instagram,
in contact?
Instagram, at Acacia Lewis, A-C-A-C-E-A-L-E-W-I-S, or acacialewis.com.
Okay, and just to make sure everybody got that, it's C-E, not C-I.
Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Acacia. And I'm really glad that we've been able to connect. We've been able to get to know each other a little bit. And, you know, I just look forward to more in the future. It's been a pleasure having you on. And just thank you so much for all that you've shared and for being willing to do the research and do the work and share it. It's really awesome.
Thank you so much, Martin. I really appreciate your time. And I look forward to our next time getting to chat and hang out.